Up next on every channel and website, it's the new talk show, The Winning with Charlie Sheen.
For the week of March 6, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 95, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. Filled with tiger blood and Adonis DNA, I'm Jay Sperling Reich, winning in Los Angeles.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
I take it you're over the whole Charlie Sheen news then.
Well, not from a business point of view, but yeah, it's a little much.
Yes, that's true. Of course, there's no way we can avoid covering all the Charlie Sheen news.
Yes, we can.
Which has been dominating, I guess, not only entertainment news, but all the news lately. However, we'll also, on this program, be covering some of the other entertainment news, including some rumors about Google's music service and the continued dominance of American Idol in the ratings. A little later on during the show, we'll be joined by Eric Deggans from the St. Petersburg Times, who will be here to discuss his NPR opinion piece on how mixed-race couples are portrayed on television. We'll also talk to Paid Content's Andrew Wallenstein about why studios should start a war over premium video on demand. Of course, we always cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who is really sick of Charlie Sheen, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
The number one movie at the box office did not star Charlie Sheen. It was called Rango, the animated film featuring the voice of Johnny Depp. It grossed $38 million in a very solid debut. At number two was the Matt Damon film The Adjustment Bureau, a cross between Inception and, oh, I don't know, four or five other movies. That grossed $20.9 million. At number three was Beastly, the second attempt by Alex Pettyfer to become an international superstar. That grossed $10.1 million. At number four was Hall Pass, which dropped not bad. It had a pretty good hold, and it made $9 million for a $27 million total. Number five is the Elton John animated musical Romeo and Juliet, which has grossed $6.9 million and is now at $83 million total. At number six is the Liam Neeson film Unknown, another $6.6 million. It's over $50 million. At number seven, the Oscar winner, The King's Speech, which had a very strong hold. It made another $6.5 million. It's at $123 million in the U.S., all for a budget of $15 million. And number eight, the Adam Sandler film Just Go With It, which has now just about equaled its budget. It's grossed $88 million. Number nine is another Alex Pettyfer film, I Am Number Four, which is number two on his list of movies. That grossed $5.7 million and has made $46 million total. Justin Bieber, Never Say Never, is at number 10. That's at $68 million total, one of the highest grossing concert films of all time. And at number 11, opening, if that's the word, Take Me Home Tonight, an 80s-themed comedy starring Topher Grace, one of my favorite actors, that died, grossing just $3.5 million.
What happened to Topher Grace? I liked him as well. Well, I guess I like him as well, but I guess
you're putting him in the past tense. Oh, my God.
Well, I mean, after this weekend's non-opening of Take Me Home Tonight, one might tend to do that.
Well, this is a movie that the studio sat on for a while. They didn't do anything with it. So, you know, it's a movie that they dumped. So I don't think that reflects poorly on him necessarily. He's, you know, he was in Valentine's Day this last year. That made over $100 million. He was in Spider-Man 3, obviously, playing Venom. Which is, you know,
that's
a big
true
blockbuster. He's, you know, he's had some really good choices. I really loved In Good Company. I know that's a movie we both like. I know he's made some really good small films like P.S. and some other things. Traffic, of course, was a smart choice. So I think he has good taste, but we're all waiting for him to really break out as an actor and start to claim really good roles. He's got a number of things, feature films and TV in the works. So, you know, he's a good actor. He's young. He's probably got all the money in the world with that 70s show, so he can afford to be choosy, maybe.
Yeah, that's true.
But Rango, I was intrigued by one of the comments you made about Rango. Tell us.
Oh, well, I mean, if you know, read the box office punditry on Sunday evening, everybody was saying that, you know, look, the film cost between $135 million and $150 million to produce. You know, they expected it to do at least $40 million opening weekend because, you know, times four, which is generally what you do opening weekend times four, is generally what you'll make in North America. So if they made $40 million, it would be up around $160 million. They'd make their money back in theatrical gross, and then, of course, go on to make money elsewhere overseas in ancillary markets like home video. But they're saying $38 million is a bit of a disappointment. Now, remember, there were no 3D ticket surcharges because Rango was not in 3D.
Yay!
Now, did you see the movie?
No, I didn't, but a friend saw it, and they called me on Saturday and said how much they liked it. It was a family, parent, two kids. They thought it was really good. The adults liked the adult jokes, which went over the kids' heads, but were not sort of in-your-face, sticky jokes like you'd find in Shrek. They were a little more subtle. But they liked it up and down the line. The really good voice cast with Bill Nighy and Johnny Depp and a bunch of other actors.
And Tim Olyphant, believe it or not, does a great Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, and, you know, it had great word of mouth. I think anybody saying this movie is a loser is an idiot. You know, it opened. They opened the film. Johnny Depp did his job. It got great word of mouth. You know, the Friday to Saturday receipts were really strong. It jumped quite strongly on Saturday, showing that people were texting and calling their friends and saying this is a fun movie. A four multiple is actually quite a strong multiple. I don't think that's a given for movies.
No, it's not.
Three is more likely. A four multiple would mean the movie had really good legs, which I think this film can expect to have. And if it grosses four times $38 million, that's about $160 million in the U.S., which will be just fine. Then you're looking at $300 to $400 million worldwide, and everybody's happy.
Right. And, it opened in 33 foreign markets over the weekend, $16.5 million. So,
well, it's just getting going overseas. Obviously, to open in the rest of the world takes a while. But that is, you know, it's March, and to say $38 million opener is weak or lame just because you were making up a number you thought it might or should hit is silly. What matters is what it ends up with, and this is a very solid launch. No, Take Me Home Tonight. Obviously, you opened to $3.5 million. That's pretty disastrous. You might make it back on DVD or something. That movie won't, but. You know, Rango, $38 million, and they're rolling their eyes and saying, oh, that looks a little weak.
Well, it's the highest opening weekend gross of any film this year.
Well, yeah, of course, but that's January and February. That's perfectly natural that it should be. That's not a high bar to meet. But what matters is how it does next weekend and the weekend after that. You know, if it holds really well, then the people who were saying, oh, this movie's a flop, will suddenly have to eat their words.
Well, I want to get back to some February openings and how the box office is doing in January and February in just a moment. But you didn't see Rango. I saw a screening of it, and I have to say, somebody asked me afterwards, and I took my two daughters, and everything went over their head. I mean, they're, you know, one, of course, is 4.5, so I expect a lot to go over her head. But I mean, they were just completely confused by the entire plot. They had no idea what was going on. And somebody asked me afterwards, what did you think of the movie? And I said, look, it was very good, but so was Chinatown. You know, it's
but I mean, nobody's saying you should bring a 4.5-year-old to it. It's not, you know, Pinocchio. It's Rango. It's this Western with a lot of, you know, but will it work for 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 14-year-olds? Yes.
Yes, it will. Yes.
Yeah. My friend had an 8-year-old daughter and a 12, 13-year-old son. And they, you know, obviously some jokes went past them. They didn't get all the movie references. You know, they liked it a lot. There are very few movies you can take a 4-year-old to.
My kids loved Romeo and Juliet. That was definitely on their level. And that's made $41.6 million overseas already. And, you know, I read this piece where Elton John is really upset with Disney over this film because he claims they didn't back it at all. The quote was, we fought resistance from the Disney studio for so long, and to be honest with you, the film has taken $75 million in America, and we haven't had a message of congratulations from anyone within the studio.
Well, you know, Disney did not do the full court press on this movie. That's very clear, both the opening and the way they launched it. They launched it, and it's making money, so, you know. But he's certainly right that he was met a lot of resistance up and down the line. It was not one of their projects. You know, they brought it on and distributed it. I don't think they ever felt like it was their baby.
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, certainly he produced it and Rocket Pictures, his company, produced it. So I think you're right. They felt like it was more of an acquisition rather than a homegrown piece of content.
But he's right that they you know, looking at what it's made, that they perhaps left a lot of money on the table.
Right. Now, you mentioned that The King's Speech had a modest drop-off of 11.4% after winning Best Picture at the Oscars. Black Swan continues to do well both in the United States and North America, as well as overseas, where internationally it's grossed $147 million, earning an additional $15.6 million this weekend.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's remarkable. But now, there were some stories over the weekend about how the box office in North America is down 22% and how attendance-wise, it was the worst year.
Worst February.
Sorry, yes. The worst February since 1995.
Okay. These things come in cycles. That's what happens. you know, I'm preparing for a story we're going to do in a week or two, a couple episodes about looking at the box office long term. You compare it to last year, of course, it's down. The worst since 95 in attendance. That's not good. But, you know, things. What good movies were released in February? Name one. Highest grossing movie was the Adam Sandler film Just Go With It.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, they're you know, when there are not good movies out, then you don't get good box office. They'll pick, you know, they'll have some hits. They got a lot of big movies coming this summer. You know, things will pick up. And even I think looking at the North American box office will be passé, I think, in 5 to 10 years.
That's probably true, especially with films opening day and date.
Right. The Adjustment Bureau, for example, opened at $20.9 million in the U.S. It opened overseas and grossed another $21.5 million. I think in 5 years, 10 years, we're going to be looking at the weekend box office worldwide. Instead of thinking about just the U.S., we'll be saying, oh, you know, Avatar 4 opened up on 8 gazillion screens and grossed $307 million worldwide. You know, I think we'll just be talking about the top 10 worldwide movies.
Well, there are a couple reasons for that, of course. You've got digital cinema making it a lot easier to distribute worldwide, both practically and logistically. So you don't have to ship prints back and forth and wait for prints to finish in one territory and then move them to a next. But then everybody's trying to combat piracy. So the industry doesn't want people in North America or a foreign territory taking a camcorder in, you know, videotaping the screen and then putting it online, ruining their chances for a good box office take in other countries.
I mean, why not? Why spend the money to launch a movie in the U.S.? Why not use that campaign and launch it worldwide? Obviously, it's not for small films like Black Swan or, you know, The King's Speech, but for big properties in the summer and the fall and Christmas, why not? You know, digital cinema and piracy and all that really affects people, and it's going to affect their windows on video on demand and all that. We'll get to that later. But there is good news in the world of entertainment and sales. You can rebound from piracy and digital, you know, the digital hit that movies are going to take.
And how do you do that?
Of course, referring to music.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about making an awkward transition, but a genuine one to music. It's actual good news.
I knew that you were going to like this story because I saw that Adele's 21. Now she's she's just turned 21 and her album.
No, she wrote the songs when she was 21. Okay. She's 22 or 23, actually.
See, that shows you what I know about Adele. I'll tell you, that album is fantastic. Whether she's 21 or 23, I don't care. The album's great. And it sold over 300,000 copies to land at number one on the Billboard 200.
And 300,000 copies sounds like 1.2 million copies, frankly, in this day and age.
So 300,000 is the new 1.2 million.
Exactly. I mean, really, weeks ago, we were talking about record lows of a number one album selling 40,000 copies, 42,000 copies. And that was just shocking. This is an actual solid debut on the charts. And it's a real breakthrough for her. I mean, her first album, 19, sold well in the U.S., but debuting at number one, selling 300,000 copies out of the box. She's got a song that's at number, I think, 13 on the charts and rising.
That's a great song.
Rolling in the Deep. And it's a terrific album. I highlighted it on the Huffington Post. I highlight a different CD every week. And I say, this is the best album that's around right now. This is what's on my mind. And I perhaps that's why it went to number one. Perhaps it is my plug on Huffington Post that did it.
Are you winning?
Oh, God.
Checking.
It's all good news. And I will say, having looked at the album online to see how it was selling and what was going on with it, I have noticed in the last few weeks going onto Amazon that they've basically stopped their practice of selling new albums for $5. At the end of last year, pretty much any major release coming out, they were selling it for $5 or $6 at a discount to drive traffic. And that has completely stopped.
Now they wait a couple weeks, if not months. And then they, you know, I get an email every weekend that says, you know, here are the $5 albums on, you know, Amazon's MP3 store. And they're usually albums, if they're new, they're a couple months old, maybe 1 or 2 months.
Right. And they used to be day and date. So now if you look at Adele's album, it's $9, $10, just like the CD, frankly. Do you find that there's still major releases or are they smaller releases as well in older catalog titles?
Both.
Yeah.
So, yeah, which I like, frankly.
Yeah. No, certainly. Yeah.
For $5, it makes me say, you know what? I'm not going to go pirate this. Not that I would anyway, but I'm not going to go pirate this. For $5, I'm going to download it and I'm going to get a crisp, clean copy.
Yeah. For $9, I'm not buying it. But for $5, I bought quite a few albums towards the end of the year for $5. I just thought, well, that's, you know, that's a real bargain. I'm ready to purchase a lot of stuff I wouldn't necessarily. And it's not that I'm choosing to buy one album on CD and not get the two others. I'm just not buying it, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, another album, I guess, last week was Mumford & Sons, and their Sign No More album fell to number two, or no, from number two to number three with 71,000 copies. I mean, this band is just taking off.
Right, 71,000 copies is sad for a number three album on the charts. I still have to get over these numbers. But I guess I'm used to box office at movies where, you know, the numbers are bigger and bigger than ever. And people say, 38 million opener, oh, that's terrible. You know, we get so jaded. And the reverse is true in music, where the numbers are so low nowadays that it takes me a little time to adjust. But yeah, no, it's just thrilling to see that they're going to go gold, obviously, I think. And that's just a real wonderful breakthrough.
I think they went platinum, actually. I think they've already gone platinum. Yeah, I think I read in Rolling Stone that they went
already?
Platinum.
Already? No.
Remember, the album's been out for over a year.
I don't think they've gone platinum.
Don't make me go get my Rolling Stone magazine.
They haven't marked it on the charts yet, so I don't think they've gone platinum.
I know they got a huge bump from the Grammys, and I know a couple weeks ago we highlighted on our Grammy episode, or the week after the Grammys, about how, is his name Steve Stout? How do you pronounce his name?
I don't know how to say it.
The week after the Grammys, he took out a full-page ad in the New York Times bashing the Grammy Awards for not being kind of current. And
which is insane.
Yeah.
It was the year that Arcade Fire won Best Album.
Yeah, he says, I have come to the conclusion that the Grammy Awards have clearly lost touch with contemporary popular culture, which, hello, they gave the top award to the Arcade Fire, which is playing not one, not two, but three major music festivals this summer.
And he said that Eminem and Kanye West were being dissed, and they've both received over, I think, a dozen Grammy Awards over the years.
But apparently the Academy was listening, because on Thursday, the Academy itself seemed to acknowledge a need for changes to the Grammy system. Issuing a joint statement signed by Mr. Stout and Neil Portnow, the Academy's president, saying that they had agreed to talks about, quote, how the Recording Academy can continue to evolve in ever-changing cultural environments.
That blows my mind, because his comments were ridiculous and stupid. And the idea that I don't even mind that they would talk to him. I mean, he's an industry player, I guess. But wow. I mean, you know, that's just that we're going to meet with him like he's the man, like he's Quincy Jones or something back in the day, where they have to, you know, have a summit with him to discuss how to fix the Grammys. Like, what the hell? If he had some useful comments, make them and they'll take them under advisement. But I can't believe he got that reaction from them.
No, I'm a little shocked that they legitimized his his ad and his whole existence, frankly, by doing that.
He's a manager of Nas. He's not, you know, he is an industry person. Who somebody beat him up or attacked him. Some rapper sort of messed him up. Who was that? I forget. But that's probably what he's most famous for. But yeah, he worked with Nas for many years, and that's a great artist.
Well, not anymore. Now he's more famous for publishing this 850-word open letter in the New York Times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't mean to say the guy's a joke, but I'm surprised that they legitimized it to this degree. But you were right, actually. I looked it up. Mumford & Sons have gone platinum in the U.S., or at least they've sold a million copies. And they've also sold a million in the U.K., which is really impressive for that market.
I was not right. Rolling Stone was right. But really, let's face it. I mean, you've mentioned it, Michael. The music industry is changing. And of course, one of the ways it's changing is there are all these subscription services, whether it's Pandora, which is more of like a radio service that doesn't really cost that much. I think it's $1 per month if you want to listen to more than 30 hours of commercial-free, hand-picked music just for you. And there's Spotify in the EU. But now everybody has been waiting for the other shoe to drop on some of these subscription services. And what is that shoe? It's Google getting into this kind of iTunes streaming subscription market.
Well, I don't know what you mean. I mean, what market, what service are they preparing? Because, I mean, iTunes doesn't offer that. So what service are they offering?
You're right. You're absolutely right. iTunes does not offer streaming. It does not offer a digital locker. It really just, it's a store.
Yeah.
And so the Music Void published a post here that says the recording industry is hoping that Google's music service will actually help them combat Apple and help save their business.
Well, it's always good to have more people. Are they just going to sell music, or what are they offering? What is their spin? Are they offering, you know, a digital subscription where you pay X dollars a month and you get access to all the music in their library, or what is it?
Well, it seems based on what the Music Void is saying, that the service will be nothing more than a simple iTunes download clone, with the added element of a locker service. And what a locker service is online is you get to store your music online, and then you can take it with you even though you don't have your computer. You can listen to it on your phone or in the car or on somebody else's computer. And of course, it's going to be a paid service, and they're pegging it somewhere around $30 a year.
Does this mean music you buy through them or all the music on your hard drive?
That's a big question. That's a huge question because, of course, EMI is suing a group. I don't know who they're suing. They're suing somebody for providing a digital locker that allows people to upload their music into a digital locker and then listen to it anywhere. EMI says, well, that's another use. That's not fair use.
That's malarkey. I hope that goes to the Supreme Court. I hope
everybody's saying that lawsuit will, if not be thrown out or withdrawn by EMI, completely fail.
Well, I hope it goes all the way and fails. I mean, they always try to restrict your fair use. That's absolutely fair use. Why shouldn't you be able to, you know, you have absolutely the right to listen to, you know, that service doesn't take away anything from anything they offer. As long as you legally own your music, that's like saying I can't sit in my living room and listen to it. You know, I mean, what's the difference?
Well, needless to say, Google is nowhere near finishing off all of their licenses with the major album labels. And they really don't think that a product is going to be released until maybe sometime this summer, if not the fall. And that seemed to be a big deal. And I'm thinking, how is that a big deal? Who cares? I mean, iTunes has been around for 6 years, so we have to wait a couple more months for Google to get into the game. It's not going to make or break Google's music service.
How does this help Google? How does this help their everything they do seems to be designed to strengthen their presence in your life? How does this launching this music service work with everything else they do?
Well, think about the parallels here. You've got Apple with its iOS and iTunes, and you've got Google.
Well, iOS? What's iOS?
That's the operating system on its phones and iPad. And you've got Google with Android, which is its operating system for tablet computers and
smartphones,
but they don't have a music service. So really, this is all about boosting up the Android platform and giving it something along the lines of an iTunes to compete with Apple and iTunes.
So it is a store, really. I mean, even if the locker doesn't work, they do want to offer a store where you can buy stuff just to compete with Apple and Amazon, obviously.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Okay. But, you know, since we're talking about music, Michael, I actually, believe it or not, have a musical intro to our television news this week. Do you want to hear it?
Is it like a classic theme song? I'd love to hear it.
Well, it might become a classic theme song. Hold on, here it is.
To quote the great Allen Iverson, you know what's coming. Come on, guys, we're talking about practice.
I got magic at my fingertips, so I have real fame, they have nothing.
I missed practice. Look at me. Yeah. I'm a freaking rock star from Mars.
And we are, I don't know,
winning
every second.
Winning.
Oh, my God. We are
winning. Drug test online.
Oh, wait, can't process it. Losers winning. Bye-bye.
Oh, God, please.
Yeah, look, it was a mashup that I think was first run on TMZ. It's an interesting mashup of all of the many interviews that Charlie Sheen has done over the past, I don't know, week or two.
Talk about the dangers of social media in the hands of a star.
Yes, well, we should probably get to our Charlie Sheen news here. And we have a registered, trademarked, and copyrighted segment of Showbiz Sandbox called Charlie Sheen Headline Marathon. Michael, do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Charlie Sheen unleashes attorney Marty Singer on Warner Brothers and CBS.
Sheen is surrounded by a coterie of enablers.
Mel Gibson to Charlie Sheen. Thanks, pal, for making me look almost sane.
I love that one. Charlie Sheen's obituary in the works in major network newsrooms.
Charlie Sheen in talks with HDNet.
Charlie Sheen sets new Guinness Twitter record.
Charlie Sheen, who needs 2.5 men when you have Twitter?
Charlie Sheen to start tweeting endorsements.
David Arquette references Charlie Sheen in post-car collision tweet.
Charlie Sheen Ustream show attracts more than 100,000 viewers.
Charlie Sheen to make humanitarian trip to Haiti with Sean Penn. Please stay there.
Oh my God. Yeah, it got a little out of control, frankly, with the whole Charlie Sheen news.
But it's fascinating with the new social media, how you can have the last laugh, make an end run around the media. You know, I mean, he's crazy, you know, whatever, but he's being entertaining. I mean, he went online with an hour-long show. He just did another 15-minute online show today, apologizing for the first show.
Now, show you, we should say that he went on Ustream at the very last minute on Saturday. He kind of just you know, send
He's not doing anything well in advance. He's not planning shit out at this point.
That's true.
That's not how you win.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's interesting.
Winners are spontaneous. Winning.
He went on all the networks. I'm sorry. He went on all the networks and did the rounds. But then he just goes online and streams for an hour and people watch him. And then he gets covered in all the media for it.
Yeah. I mean, and I watched part of it. It was on in the background on Ustream while I was doing some other work. But I only realized it because I was looking at Twitter and everybody was tweeting about it. So I came in maybe 10 minutes into the show and, you know, it had 100 some odd thousand viewers and it slowly began to drop the longer he talked. And it was rambling and it was all over the place, much like his media interviews. But I have to say, if there's one thing that has come out of these media interviews, it's that it's kind of a study on how he has been able to create these catchphrases like "duh winning" and also "tiger blood." He said his veins were filled with tiger blood and that he was, you know, comprised of Adonis DNA, you know. So he says all these things and now he's actually making T-shirts and bumper stickers, and I mean, he actually.
Well, other people were making them. Is he now making them himself?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, but he doesn't need the money. He's just having fun.
I think at this point he's having fun. Although I do have to say, if you watch these interviews, they're rather disturbing.
But you know, again, it raises the question. He's very confident. He says he's going to be back on the show. How does CBS fire him? How does CBS? Did they cancel their number one show? I can't see it happening. And if they do, I think he's got a good case. For all of his nuttiness, he's there. He passed a drug test. He's in the news. He's as popular as ever. He's, you know, a rapscallion, just like the character on the show. I don't see how they can, you know, cancel the show and fire him without paying him a lot of money.
Well, especially now that he's got 1.4 million Twitter followers and counting, and the guy only got on Twitter last week, and within 25 hours, he had 1.2 million Twitter followers, which was that's what set the Guinness record there.
Because he's so popular and because he's been on the number one sitcom in the country for, you know, 5, 7, 8 years now. So, you know, it all feeds into each other. It's not that CBS now needs him because he has a lot of Twitter followers. He has a lot of Twitter followers because he's on the number one sitcom in the country and is making news every minute.
Right. Now, and I know that for you and even for me, I mean, this is kind of enough is enough already. And I over the weekend was checking my email, and XM Radio sent me an email saying that for 24 hours, they were turning one of their channels into Tiger Blood Radio, and they just cut together all of their talk shows from the past week where their hosts were talking about Charlie Sheen or where they had guests on being interviewed about Charlie Sheen. And I thought, well, what could this possibly be? I tuned in for like half an hour. They had a ton of content, and it ran for 24 hours.
And they had like a Playboy bunny and ex-girlfriends who were on there talking about him. And, you know, yeah, but mainly it was a stunt to bring attention to Sirius XM or whatever it's called these days, which was a good idea.
Right. And as I was, you know, that was kind of a sidetrack from what I was originally saying, which is to you, this is not serious. And you kind of look down on it, as do, I think, a lot of people. But for NBC, which ran a 1 hour Dateline special, for ABC, which ran a 1 hour 2020 special, and for TMZ especially, I mean, this is gold for them. But I can't help but think, listening to all of this and watching all of this unfold, that whether he is on drugs or not, that there is something wrong with Charlie Sheen in a medical... there's something medically wrong with him, that he's not right. And
aren't you around Hollywood people enough to know about obsessed, crazed people who are egotistical and think the world revolves around them?
Well, yeah.
This is different than that?
That it's a lot different than that. I mean, he is like off the rails. And I kind of look at that and say, you know what? If he had cancer or if he had Alzheimer's or Parkinson's and the media were taking advantage of him in this way, it would be frowned upon. Whereas
if he had cancer and went on ABC to do an interview talking about his battle with cancer, like, say, Michael Douglas went on Letterman, that wouldn't be taking advantage of him.
No, but now they've gone, I think, too far in that.
Well, they're not medical doctors. He hasn't been diagnosed as mentally unstable, whatever your, you know, half-assed opinion is looking at him on TV.
Hey, my half-assed opinion comes with absolutely no medical training whatsoever.
Okay. But you know what I mean? I mean, how responsible are they to say this is a major celebrity? Are they supposed to say, wait, I think he might need medical help. We need to pull back.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, they're saying, oh, all of the people surrounding him are enablers, but so is the media at this point. I mean, they're the ones kind of prolonging this. And, You know, what would happen if, heaven forbid, something horrible were to happen to Charlie Sheen and, you know, he becomes injured or, heaven forbid, dies?
Is there some reason to think that he's suicidal or
I'm just saying, let's just say in during this episode of his life, something horrible happens. Do you think that the media would change the way it handles such situations with celebrities in the future?
No.
Do you think that they would consider themselves complicit in whatever horrible thing, heaven forbid, might happen?
They aren't and they wouldn't.
Okay, well.
If you have a certifiably unhinged person and give them a platform and encourage their craziness for a reality show or something, you might have some responsibility where you knowingly, but he's, you know, he's saying goofy things. I don't think that you can necessarily say he's unstable and about to harm himself or others, and therefore they're, you know.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying.
Showing reckless. If they're not, if you can't say that, then they're not behaving, you know, improperly.
Okay. Well, you know, I guess I'm just saying like what would happen. Well, anyway.
They would for a week they would feel bad and then we'd go back to normal.
Yeah, that's probably true. But you know what's remarkable? $1 million a year is how much he could potentially make by signing with Adley for his sending out Twitter endorsements. It's remarkable.
Why? But it's not remarkable. Why bother? He makes that an episode practically on Two and a Half Men. Why the hell would he bother with that, cheapening his name and image?
You know what? I'm just talking about the fact that anybody could make $1 million a year sending out tweets. Forget about whether it's Charlie Sheen or not. I'm just saying, wow.
Imagine what Oprah would get.
Quite a lot. But you're right. I mean, he's on the number one sitcom in North America and maybe even the world. Who knows? But there's another number one show that I know you wanted to talk about.
Well, we don't have Karen Woodward to knock it back and forth with, but I did want to talk about American Idol. It's the number one show in the country. It remains the number one show in the country during its 10th season. Dancing with the Stars is still to come. But it's looking really great. The big change is they moved it from Tuesday and Wednesday to Wednesday and Thursday. Thursday night is the biggest night of television for the networks because that's where they make the most money because people run all their movie ads for shows that are coming out on Friday. So when, you know, Rango comes out on Friday, they love to run ads Thursday night. So moving the number one show to a new night is risky. Moving it to Thursday, the most competitive night of television, is risky. And the show has not, you know, dropped a beat. It's down about 10% from last year, which is perfectly natural for a show in its 10th season. And it's amazing. And I have to say, you know, some of the big changes, obviously, Steven Tyler and Jennifer Lopez. I was really worried about how they would turn out. But throughout most of the show this season, they've been really good.
I've been actually surprised at how good they've been. I've only watched a couple of the early episodes, but they seem like they're doing quite well.
Yeah, I've learned that the idol is bigger than the judges. Even though Simon is gone and Paula is gone, it still feels like American Idol. But the casting of the judges really matters. And these three, Steven and Jennifer and Randy, have really good chemistry. They get along together. They feel like a team. They're really optimistic and, you know, rooting for the kids. And it's a lot of fun. However, yeah, I did have the caveat that the hard part was when they would have to do the critiques during the live shows. That sitting there and saying, you get to go to Hollywood and being goofy, that's easy. The hard part is when they go live.
Right. Well, so you're saying when somebody has to say, you know, tonight you stunk. What were you thinking? Why'd you do that song?
Well, it's not so much that they have to be mean, but they have to say something interesting and constructive and helpful, whether it's good or bad. They have to be interesting and offer a useful critique or people are going to get bored. And I have to say the live shows were a disaster. First of all, the people they picked, to me, are terrible. I mean, there's not a single guy I'm interested in practically, almost none of the women. I have nobody to root for yet. That could change as we get to know them. But I would say out of the performances, there were 24, I would say 20 of them were bad, like off key, flat, bad, awkward, terrible. Steven Tyler and Jennifer Lopez said nothing. Every performance was the best performance they've ever seen in their life. Oh my God, you're so beautiful. Oh, you're being you. Oh, you're so one. I think they made about two negative critiques the whole time. Nothing they said was of interest or value. They literally, I mean, it was awful. As a live television, to me, my jaw was dropped.
Do you think that audiences will eventually kind of get tired of that? And
They will. They've got to be more, even if they're saying something positive, they have to say something more interesting. Oh, you're beautiful. I love you. You know, they have to say something good and interesting. And when they can't offer a useful critique that's negative, that's bad. It's not about being mean, which Simon, frankly, never really was. He was just blunt. But to me, it's a big problem going forward. And we'll have to see. Maybe they'll get better. But that's a little bit of a warning signal. But they have a lot of new changes. You know,
do you think that the online voting will actually help it?
Well, online voting is good, but they still feel like, you know, looming in the shadows is the X Factor. You know, American Idol announced you could finally vote online on their website. X Factor is letting you vote online on Facebook. They have this big partnership with Facebook. So instead of having to go to the Idol site, you can just do it on your Facebook page, which makes it so much easier and so much cooler and hipper. They're having, you know, they've got their judges. Simon and Cowell was making news talking about maybe signing Paula Abdul again.
That would be such a smart move. I can't even tell you how smart that move would be.
Yeah, why not do it? George Michael.
Oh, that would be another brilliant move. Although it would be brilliant in theory. I don't know about practice.
No, I think he's very smart about the music business. And I think he would be, I don't know how he'd be on live TV, but I think he'd be really good because he's always very self-aware and very able to look at his music in the industry from a very smart point of view. So I actually think he'd be a really good pick too. So that's looming in the background. But Idol has a lot of things up its sleeve. They've got, you know, mentors, Jimmy Iovine, the big record music label guy. They're going to have all the kids in a house together. So they're going to be showing backstage drama more than ever. And while I've been very pleased with how the show did so far and their chemistry, the judges really have to pick up their game.
Well, Michael, I don't want to change subjects on you too quickly, especially since it's a subject I know you're quite well versed in, but we are running a little long and we do have a guest to speak with during our television segment this week. So maybe we should move on and speak with Eric Deggans, the television and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. Now, last week, Eric provided an audio commentary to NPR, National Public Radio, in which he discussed how mixed-race couples are portrayed on television shows. And actually, I guess we really have to thank Eric for joining us today to discuss this commentary, because if the text alert that I just received about Charlie Sheen is at all accurate, then you must be quite busy today.
Yeah, it's been a busy day because here in St. Petersburg and around the world, the news has just gone out that Charlie Sheen got fired from Two and a Half Men. So we've been running around here trying to figure out how we want to cover it for tomorrow. And I think in a weird way, everyone expected this, but in another way, it's a little shocking, even though you expect it, it's a little shocking when it happens. So,
Eric, will you be able to cover the trial when Charlie Sheen sues them for tens of millions of dollars?
I'm going to put in for a flight to Los Angeles and a suite at the Beverly Hilton, but I wouldn't hold my breath.
I actually didn't expect it. I thought there was too much money involved and that he was sober and ready to work and – you know, his character was a nut.
He was
so
winning. Well, you know, I've written a couple of times about this for the newspaper. We've tried to hold back a little because it does seem a little like piling on. But when production on the show was first stopped, I wrote a column where I noted that, you know, he had allegedly threatened his wife, his third wife, with a knife. He had allegedly pushed and hit his second wife, Denise Richards. He trashes a hotel room. You know, he has all these violent incidents in his past. But the minute he starts insulting the producer of his show, that's when they shut down production. So I think there was probably a sense that creative partnership was never going to be rekindled. And I think CBS and Warner Brothers, because CBS airs the show, Warner Brothers actually creates the episodes. It's the production company that creates the episodes. They were probably getting all their legal ducks in a row to make sure that they knew what they were going to be doing when and if a lawsuit came to bear. And they moved today to announce that he's been fired. Warner Brothers officially cut the cord.
But don't you think he's going to have a pretty good lawsuit? I mean, Chuck Lorre has been mocking him for a long time on the little cards that end episodes of some of his shows. They've been having this back and forth. He's apparently drug-free and ready to work. And for whatever happens in his private life, he's never had any, you know, on-set problems where they've said you've been, you know, delaying production or having problems as a professional on your job. It's one thing to judge his private life about how he treats his spouse.
Just because he says that he hasn't had any problems doesn't mean that he hasn't had any problems. And my sense is that there will be some kind of conference where lawyers from one side sit down with Sheen's people and say, here's chapter and verse on every mistake he made, every time he showed up late, every time he blew off a table read, every time he tripped and fell, every time he stumbled, every time we had to delay production because of him.
And all of which they accepted and worked with and signed him up for 2 more years just a few months ago. You know, so they clearly were happy to work with him again, knowing his professionalism.
You know, the argument they'll make is that they were hoping he would go to rehab, and they had kept pressuring him to go to rehab, and that they stopped production to the show for a month so he could go to rehab. He didn't go into rehab. He went home. and then after, you know, 2 weeks, started doing public media appearances saying he was okay when he clearly wasn't. I think they have a pretty strong case that he, even though he thought he was ready to work, he wasn't. I think the main thing about lawsuits like this is that nobody wants their dirty laundry aired. So CBS and Warner Brothers wanted to protect the cash cow. They wanted to keep things rolling. They didn't want things out there in the public about whatever they may have done to paper over what was happening just to keep things going. But when it gets to lawsuit time, you know, the gloves are going to come off, and we're going to find out what everybody actually did. And it'll be – I don't know if Sheen – is in his right mind now, or will be in his right mind when those decisions get made. But somebody from CBS is going to sit down with these people with a thick folder filled with everything that he's actually done. And all of it will become public. And for somebody who makes a living as an actor, if he's in his right mind, he won't want all that in the public space.
You mean he won't be tweeting about it nonstop or putting it on Sheen's Corner?
If he's in his right mind, he won't. And that's a big if. But I mean, that's generally how these lawsuits go. You know, everybody's got their own little history that they've been keeping. And then the question sort of becomes, do you want this lawsuit bad enough to endure having all this stuff become public? And then the settlement talk starts. So
right.
Maybe he should head to Clearwater and get a purification rundown.
I mean, you know, my hope, yeah, Scientology reference, very good. My hope really is that he goes into treatment at some point, and you know, a lawsuit doesn't become necessary because he's getting the help he needs. Definitely.
So now tell us about your article and the feedback you've gotten. You were talking about the depiction of interracial couples on primetime television. And how you felt it was a little less realistic than you like. You felt that TV shows did feature some interracial couples, but that race was not interwoven into their lives and storylines as much as you thought they should be.
Basically, I noticed way back in July that there were a bunch of shows that were planned to come to fruition during this TV season that had interracial couples as part of the core cast. And there's probably about 7 or 8 of them on now. That have come on in, say, the last year or two. You know, ABC's Modern Family, I think, is the best example, with Sofia Vergara and Ed O'Neill playing this May December couple, and she's Colombian and he's an Anglo. And I think they do a great job of sort of showing how her culture impacts their lives, and, you know, they talk a lot about how their cultures are different. But you have these new shows. Fox has one called Traffic Light that's about two couples and a friend who hang out together. They're all relatively young. One's married, one's about to get married, and one guy is having fun being single. And the married couple, the woman is an Asian. There's, in Parenthood, the NBC series, there are actually two interracial couples. One is a white guy and a black woman, sort of a flighty guy who didn't know that he had a son with this dancer that he had slept with 5 years ago, and then she shows up and she has the kid, and he decides to try and be a part of their life. And there's a few other series kind of like that where there are interracial couples, and Mr. Sunshine, Matthew Perry's new show for ABC. And then ABC has a show called Happy Endings that's going to debut in April. One of the Wayans kids is going to be half of an interracial couple there, a black man and a white girl. So what struck me when I was watching these shows is that, you know, they often never talk about race. It never comes up in any way, shape, or form. And I'm in an interracial marriage myself, and I've been married to a white woman for almost 20 years, and I have a lot of friends who are in interracial relationships, and I have a friend who's a journalist in Los Angeles who's writing a book about this, and we all kind of agree that these depictions feel weird. They feel plastic. They feel unreal. It's not that you're walking around sitting at the back of the bus every day, or somebody is causing a confrontation every day. But there are often times when the fact that you're in an interracial relationship sort of comes to your attention because of how somebody else is acting.
And you mean they're acting like boneheads, basically?
Not necessarily acting like boneheads. I mean, like, I talked with this actress, Diane Farr, and her name's not a household name, but she's been on the CBS show Numbers, and she was in the cast of Rescue Me, and she's casting a pilot for Fox this year. She'll probably be on TV again. She's married to a Korean guy. And she says a lot of times people don't even ask how they met because they think that the question sounds racist. and my point is, I think it's a perfectly reasonable question to ask. I mean, in my case, you know, I'm from Gary, Indiana, kind of a steel town right next to Chicago. My wife is from Central Indiana, a very rural town. Her hometown was the nexus of the Ku Klux Klan when she was growing up. So it is kind of odd that the two of us ended up getting married. It does, doesn't it? Well, literally the first 3 or 4 years that I went to visit her mother during like the holidays, I was afraid to leave the house. I didn't know what would happen. But things have gotten much better. Her town is much more diverse now, and it's not an issue. But the first time I went to Thanksgiving dinner, two of her relatives, they were both in-laws who have since divorced the people they were married to, they would not sit in the same room with me. When I went into the dining room, they would go to the living room. When I went to the living room, they would go to the dining room. It was bizarre. So I think when that commentary came out, a lot of people assumed that what I was talking about was just people being racist everywhere, and you know, it's 1960 all over again. And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying that when you're in an interracial relationship, sometimes differences in race and culture come out in weird ways, and it feels inauthentic to me to see a couple where they never, ever talk about stuff like that.
Which is pretty much mostly what's happening on television.
On Parenthood especially, I think Parenthood is like the worst example of that, because what they'll do is the young couple, the teen couple, you know, the parents objected to this 16-year-old girl going out with this black guy. And she says, is it because he's black? And they go, no, we're just worried because he's older and he has this past as a substance abuser, and we're just not sure he's the right guy for you. And then all of a sudden, okay, so now the issue is set to the side and nobody ever mentions it again. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, life doesn't work like that, because I know from experience, somebody can tell you, no, it's not about race, but you don't necessarily know if you can believe that, particularly if you don't know the people. And having a situation where everybody just kind of says, oh, well, it's not about race then. That's the point I was trying to make, is that, you know, nowadays, the way differences in race impact our lives is subtle. And I think TV needs to challenge itself to talk about these issues rather than just making a character in a cast a person of color and saying, okay, now the cast is diverse and we can just act like we can just write the same stuff we would write if they were all white. You
know, right. I mean, there's two angles. One is the opportunity to tell an interesting, different story that they're missing.
Yeah.
And the other one is, hey, yeah, if you're trying to be cool and clever by, you know, throwing an interracial couple, you have the obligation to represent it as fairly and completely as possible.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing to me is, the thing I've always said is that your biggest struggle when you're a series television writer, in America especially, is material. It is just, there's a gargantuan amount of material that you are expected to create. Creating 22 or 24 episodes of dramatic television, an hour-long show, throughout the TV season, that's a tremendous amount of script pages. And so why would you turn away from such a juicy, interesting, compelling, different storyline than the odd ways that differences in culture come out now? If you look at the fact that we have our first black president and something like 25% of the population refuses to believe that he's Christian, and they refuse to believe that he was born in America, and there's all these weird sort of conspiracy theories floated to explain why a certain percentage of the population just cannot get comfortable with the fact that a guy named Barack Obama is their president. Now, don't tell me that if you're in an interracial relationship walking through the world, that you're not going to bump up against that sometimes.
Well, it's a fascinating article. You can find it on npr.org. We'll have the link to it in our show notes. You can follow Eric's work at the St. Petersburg Times. Do you have a Twitter account, Eric, or that people can
follow? I sure do. It's Deggins is the Twitter handle, so you can look me up there, and I'm on Facebook as well.
And good luck with forming that band in St. Petersburg so you can get playing some more funk music.
Yeah, first gig is next month, so.
Oh, congratulations.
Did I miss something here?
I just follow him on Facebook, and I have friends who work at the St. Pete Times.
Oh, okay. I understand. Well, thank you not only for discussing your – it's a very thoughtful audio essay, I guess I'd call it. But certainly you should – we'll place a link to it in the show notes. And thank you for letting us know about Charlie Sheen's new non-career.
Yeah, well, you know, he has a new career probably suing CBS. So
indeed.
this will be quite interesting to watch.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, gosh, I wish we'd known this news at the top of the hour. Do you think Charlie Sheen being fired is a big deal or a big whoop?
Yep, that's right. It's time for us to move along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment.
What? I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, well, you know, I try to move us along, keep the show flowing to a, keep it down to a modest 2-3 hours, you know. but it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story this week, another day, another disgruntled filmmaker suing the Weinsteins. The team behind the cheapy animated hit Hoodwinked accused the Weinsteins of refusing to make their next film and doing everything they can to drag out the process on the project entitled Escape from Planet Earth. They want $50 million in damages. But the really juicy detail is that the team says the Weinsteins paid them off to the tune of $500,000 just to delay filing the lawsuit until after the Academy Awards. Hey, we'll delay our lawsuit till after the Emmys if CBS sends us, I don't know, $50,000 each. Michael, is this lawsuit a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. I can't imagine how you would prove a studio was cruelly keeping a project in development hell, since that's so common in Hollywood that things don't get made or get stuck around for years and years. I think their argument is that they were going to get such a good back-end deal that the Weinsteins didn't want to make the movie. But it's funny, Hoodwink just came out on Blu-ray, and I had done a story about these guys when it hit the theaters originally about how they'd made the movie for so little money for an animated film and how they were going to revolutionize animated movies by making them cheap and be competitive. And I was wondering what the heck happened to them and why they hadn't had another project.
They've been in their lawyer's office.
That's exactly.
True. Yeah. CBS faces a tough call on its top-rated sitcom, 2.5 Men, but they established some stability in their lineup by signing the cast of How I Met Your Mother for another 2 seasons. The sitcom is in the midst of its 6th season and scored 9.2 million viewers for its most recent original episode. That means Neil Patrick Harris, Jason Segel, Allison Hannigan, and the rest of the cast should be set for life, and CBS at least can breathe easy about keeping one more piece of their primetime schedule in place. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. I mean, it was a show that looked tenuous at first. I've always liked the cast. I feel like they ran out of juice creatively a few years ago. I wish it had ended, because I think the more seasons you do, the less sort of fun it is in a way when it's still running on steam. But I'm happy for them because I like everybody involved.
Yes, suit up.
Exactly.
You have to watch the show to get that joke. Alcon, the company behind Oscar winner The Blind Side, is getting the rights to remake the sci-fi classic. Wait for it. Wait for it. Blade Runner.
Boo.
That's right, Blade Runner. Quote,
boo.
So here's the quote. This is a major acquisition for our company and a personal favorite film for both of us, Alcon co-heads Andrew Kosovi and Broderick Johnson said in a statement. So then why remake it? They plan exactly. Not just a feature film, but video games and exploitation of the Blade Runner name on all sorts of platforms. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because it's so moronic. There are plenty of properties that can and should be remade time and time again. I have no trouble with that. I have no trouble with Tron. It's a bad original movie. Perfect one to remake, even though they didn't do a great job. But Blade Runner, is not only is it a bad idea, it's not a very commercial movie, and it's perfect. It's a masterpiece. It's wildly influential, and remaking it is just moronic. And, ugh, it just makes me so angry.
I have to say, I'm not a big fan of the idea myself. Oprah has been the queen of daytime for years, not to mention a major force in publishing, TV, film, and magazines. But a cable channel is proving a harder nut to crack. Oprah's OWN, or OWN Network, is reaching about 135,000 unique viewers at a time. That's even lower than the numbers that the all but invisible Discovery Health channel that they replaced used to get. Of course, Oprah herself won't be a major presence on the channel until after her daytime talk show says goodbye in September. Is the slow start a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I like how you said unique viewers, which is sort of an online thing that you brought over to TV. It's a big whoop because it is early days. It's a slow start. You got to build up a lineup. All you need is a couple hits to sort of give your cable channel traction, get people to seeing it. But it's certainly not good news.
Yeah, I mean, their goal is to get 50 million to 60 million people viewing the channel each month. It was 135,000 viewers at any given time. So, and technically, they may not be unique viewers.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah. Star Wars is coming out in 3D. Not the good one, but Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. It finally has a release date, February 10th, 2012. That's about 8 weeks before Titanic 3D comes out in April of 2012. So, will the force be with George Lucas or James Cameron? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, the force will be with both of them. 8 weeks is plenty of time for Star Wars to make all its money before Titanic comes out. Star Wars is the more likely film, I would guess, for 3D, but Titanic is one of the biggest films of all time. You know, I think James Cameron will win this battle. I think if it was the Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, that might challenge it. But I think starting with this one means that Cameron will have the edge first time out.
You know, I actually saw, this was years ago, actually 4 years ago, pieces of Star Wars Episode IV converted into 3D, and it looked amazing. These were just tests that they were doing, and they looked fantastic. And that was 4 years ago, and, you know, 3D conversion has come a long way since then.
Yeah, they're definitely taking their time, so it'll be interesting to see. Too bad it's such an awful movie, Phantom Menace.
Ugh, yeah. North American radio giant Clear Channel picked up cloud-based music subscription service Thumbplay last week for a song.
Song, I wonder?
Get it? It's a song. You know, it's making a musical pun was intended kind of thing. Anyway, Thumbplay was overcapitalized with $41 million, but had only 20,000 subscribers. The plan is to integrate Thumbplay's personalized internet radio service into Clear Channel's iHeartRadio product and push it to Clear Channel's listenership using its vast corporate infrastructure. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for the industry. Good to have some more competitors out there for Pandora. I don't think it's a particularly interesting service or a particularly good competitor, but with Clear Channel behind it and all that base to build upon, it's it may have a shot.
Remember how we reported a couple of months ago how Courtney Love was being sued for bashing a fashion designer on Twitter? Well, apparently freedom of speech only goes so far. As part of a legal settlement, the musician and actress Courtney Love agreed to begin paying $433,000 this week to the fashion designer who claimed that Miss Love had posted multiple defamatory 140-character remarks about her on Twitter in March of 2009, ruining her reputation and her business. Although I had never heard of this designer before, and now I have, so I don't know how it ruined her business. But anyway, big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, that's what Courtney Love said. She said she helped her business. But no, having somebody mock and belittle you is not exactly a great business plan. It's a big deal. Twitter is just like everything else. You can't just randomly attack and mock people and think it doesn't count. It's too bad Courtney didn't pick on Galliano. That would have been safe.
Yeah, that would have been safe. Apparently, Phil Collins doesn't want to give us one more night. Months ago, he told Rolling Stone that he was basically retired, thanks in no small part to an illness that made it impossible for him to drum. But in the way of the internet, when he repeated the same thing to UK magazine FHM, that he was basically done with music and rather peeved that people got so sick of him, but he understood why they got so sick of him in the first place, it went around the world as if it were a breaking story. So is this rehash of his quote-unquote retirement a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, except in the sense of how it reflects how sometimes, you know, someone can pick up a statement and then blow it up again 3 months later, 6 months later, a year later. How often do we find something and people say, oh, my gosh, look at this. And you're like, hey, that was reported 9 months ago or 8 months ago. Things seem fresh again if Huffington Post puts it on the front page of the entertainment section and splashes a big headline.
Well, you know, as I always say, hey, Showbiz Sandbox reported that 6 months ago. Where were you?
Exactly.
AMC and Regal make it official. On Monday, they launched Open Road, a joint venture in which they plan to distribute 8 to 10 films a year. And not just in their own cinemas, either. They've got industry veteran Tom Ortenberg on board and plan to release their first film this fall. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
A big deal for lawyers. Let's look forward to that antitrust suit coming soon. But again, you heard it here first on Showbiz Sandbox, so I'm glad to know we were ahead of the curve on this. But it's very, very interesting. It'd be really interesting to see what movies they pick, how they distribute them, when they get them into other theaters, not just their own, how wide they do them, what their plan is. This will be very fun to see.
Yeah, it'll be fun to watch, you know, depending on how successful they are, how studios fight back and how the Department of Justice in the United States fights back, potentially. Chinese fans who have been tangled up in blue over not seeing Bob Dylan can rest easy. So can our reliance on old song titles to segue into news items. In this case, the news is that Dylan's long-scheduled plans to do some concerts in China are finally coming to fruition. In true socialist fashion, he'll be playing the Workers' Gymnasium in Beijing on April 7th, along with some other shows. Fans won't be able to understand what he's singing, of course, but that's okay, because neither can we. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, you know, it's actually kind of a big deal because it reminds us how much of China is an uncharted territory. We're really not doing a lot of business there yet. I mean, other businesses are, but the entertainment industry is really at the beginning stages of working their way into this country. It's a billion people, audience that we're talking about. And as we make inroads, it's going to be a really big, profitable area.
To give you some indication as to how big this market could be, there are 100,000 movie screens in the world today, minus those in China. And it is estimated that now that China's going through a multiplex boom, that China will have 100,000 screens just in that country alone.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a pretty big market.
And we still haven't even finished with India and Africa, both undercapitalized as well. So very interesting. And Bob Dylan is a god.
Bob Dylan is a god. Just to throw that in there.
Yeah, no, he really is.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we discuss only the news stories that people in Hollywood might care about. And this week, we are being joined by Andrew Wallenstein, who I met while he was working for The Hollywood Reporter, but he is now a part of, as of last October, paid content. Now, Andrew, how would you describe paid content? Because it's an amazing site, and if you're not visiting this site on a daily basis, you're really missing out.
Well, paid content basically covers the business of digital media, all the many different ways, whether it's through advertising or subscriptions, that content companies make some money.
Well, and one way content companies make some money is by releasing movies. So studios release movies into movie theaters. There's an issue there with the window for how long movies will stay in movie theaters before they head off into the home, which is what you wrote about last week in your piece.
Yeah, I mean, basically the studios are attempting to launch a all-new window called Premium VOD, and it is going to be a very interesting risk to watch unfold.
And what's the window between theatrical release and home video now? And what would Premium VOD do?
Well, typically, you know, you don't see anything between 90 days after a movie comes out in the theaters. And what Premium VOD would do, and we're not really clear on what the particulars are because no firm plan has been set in place, but the speculation is that anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks, maybe even 2 months, you will see a movie come into your home available for rent at what could be $30 a pop.
So $30 a pop. Now, 4 to 6 weeks. You know, one group that really must like this, besides families with children like myself, the movie theaters must really love this, the fact that...
Not quite, because the theaters are really upset that this is going to cannibalize their core product. And make no mistake, you know, obviously there's a lot of compression on all the revenue streams in the movie business right now, but the box office is the tail that wags the dog here. And so a lot of theater chains are hopping mad about the prospect of Premium VOD.
So the tail that wags the dog here, you're saying that really without a theatrical release and without all that hoopla surrounding a theatrical release, people may not even want to see it at you know, on home video or VOD.
That's exactly right. I mean, the sense is that how a movie does at the box office, while may not necessarily be the majority of the revenues that come in for any particular title, it's still something that creates momentum for some of the other windows like home video. And so that anything you do to endanger this window could have implications all the way down the chain.
So Andrew, I was wondering, what sort of demand do you think there is for this? I know that they're all fighting about this, but I'm not sure exactly who's going to say 5 weeks, 6 weeks from now, gee, I want to pay $30 to see Rango for, you know, one day.
Yeah, no, that is the really big question mark here. I think earlier, though, you alluded to the fact that you as someone in a family could actually see some value in being able to just keep the kids at home, not have to pay extras for the popcorn and such. And $30, if that is what the transactional cost is, could actually be a nice deal. So I do think there are some segments of the audience, like families, that could really gain something from this window.
But if I'm a family, I'm going to wait an extra 4 weeks and buy the DVD for $15, and then I can decide to watch it 100 times or give it away or whatever. But why pay to rent it for $30 when I can buy it for $15 or $20, you know, a few weeks later?
And you're exactly right. Of course, there is some speculation, though, that we could see some combining of the windows so that when you pay your $30 for premium VOD, you can also opt into getting a DVD when it comes out. It's not clear whether that would be an extra cost on top of the 30 or baked into the 30, but your point is well taken.
Well, as you mentioned, Andrew, Amy Miles, the CEO of Regal, the largest North American movie theater chain, says if a film has a 4 to 6 week window to a home window into the home, we're not going to give it screen time. That's outside the realm of any conversation we have had with the studios. And Jerry Lopez, the CEO of AMC Entertainment, the number two theater chain in North America, said the very same thing. And, you know, if you can't get into the theaters, then your VOD grosses will probably plummet, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, make no mistake, this can be a very big war that is developing here. I mean, it's not clear yet whether this is just, you know, tough talk for the sake of posturing in a negotiation or whether they really mean what they're going to say. But this really does have the makings of a very big fight.
But let's be clear, the theater chains that are aghast at this possibility 5 to 10 years ago would have been aghast at the idea that movies would come out on DVD 12 to 14 weeks after they hit theaters. Now
exactly.
they're taking that as a given, but they're saying, but we're absolutely not going to allow video on demand in 6 weeks. That's outrageous.
Yeah, I mean, 5 to 10 years ago, I think this would have been a different conversation where theater owners, whatever they said, is what would have been. But this is a very different situation, and I think we're going to see that the theater owners don't have quite the leverage that they used to, and therefore that becomes problematic.
So how many kids do you have, Andrew?
Just one, two-year-old.
Would you like the idea of video on demand if you when they get a little bit older and he's watching movies, or if you just don't want to have to get a babysitter, would it be cheaper for you to say, hey, I'll pay $30 to watch a movie rather than $50 to pay a babysitter?
Yeah, no, that's to the point I was making earlier. You know, I'll do anything to avoid paying for a babysitter. And at $30 cost, I mean, you know, take that against, you know, the 3 hours it may cost me, you know, $15-$20 an hour for a babysitter. The math works out.
Well, a moment or two ago, you mentioned that this was going to be a war between theater owners and studios. And your piece on paid content was titled Why Studios Should Spark a Premium VOD War. And within the piece, you kind of suggest that because people might not know about premium VOD, the market might not be aware of it, that such a war might actually benefit the studios.
Yeah, it's a bit of counterintuitive thinking, but when you really think about it, these kind of fights, when they play out in the press, and I'm thinking of other issues like everything from retransmission consent to even something like, you know, Conan O'Brien versus NBC, the way these stories get covered in effect become marketing. And so it's really in the studio's interest to spread the word here, because if they just rely on sort of the traditional industry campaigns, I don't know if those are going to be effective enough.
And let's be clear, this is going to happen because just the major studios are thinking about it, but it's already the way it works for independent film. You see a lot of times people across the country are very used to the idea that a film that opens in New York and LA, a small independent film, might become available day and date on video on demand on IFC or Sundance or somewhere else. They're very used to movies coming out on video on demand before the theatrical release or DVD comes out that day, because that movie's never going to play the entire country. And it just makes sense to do that. But as they get used to that and expect that, I think it's only natural it works its way up the food chain to bigger and bigger budgeted movies.
Yes, but I do want to mark a very clear distinction here between the kind of audience that you're talking about here, which is very sophisticated, very savvy film goers, and here where we're really talking about, you know, Joe average, Joe public types who they don't know from windows, they don't know from VOD. You just got to make it easy, simple, and affordable, and they'll follow. Very different audiences.
Well, for some of those savvy film goers, both AMC and Regal are forming a joint venture, which we spoke about earlier, that will kind of acquire some of these smaller films and release them theatrically. This is one way they're combating this window issue, is they say, okay, if you can't give us exclusive content, we'll go out and find our own content.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty alarming, but it really just goes to show that the theater owners know just how drastically the game is changing, and drastic measures are going to be taken.
Well, certainly, I'm sure that the premium VOD debate will continue long into the year, especially once the first title gets released in this manner. Andrew, thank you for taking the time to join us. Again, your content can be found on paidcontent.org, not .com. And of course, you're on Twitter. A. Wallenstein is the username to look up. Of course.
Yes, but one note, I guess you didn't hear about this. This is actually my last week at Paid Content. As of next Monday, I have joined Variety.
Oh, congratulations.
Wow. Okay, so wait a second. Let's talk about that for a second. I thought it was major news when you decided to go from The Hollywood Reporter. You were there for a very long time, 8 years, and you headed up all of their online efforts, and you went to Paid Content. I thought that was big news. Now you're moving from Paid Content to Variety. What was the decision there?
You know, it was the prospect of being able to work again with a woman who was my boss over at The Hollywood Reporter for many years, Cynthia Littleton, who obviously has a tremendous reputation in this business. It was also the ability to write about the traditional television business and the digital media business. Don't get me wrong, I absolutely love my time at Paid Content, but I'm really excited for Variety as well.
Well, certainly, we wish you a lot of luck over at Variety and look forward to reading your work there. So we'll place links to at least the Paid Content work in the show notes and, of course, your Twitter feed.
That would be great.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Breaking news here at Showbiz Sandbox.
Well, I don't know how breaking it is. I mean, I've been so busy lately that I haven't been paying attention to any of the media notes and media news.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure people know about it, but good to know.
Yeah, I guess 5 days ago it was announced by Media Bistro that Andrew was moving from Paid Content to Variety.
So well, I guess you should be checking your inbox more often.
I should be checking my inbox. Speaking of inboxes, as a matter of fact, we have some listener email. Before we actually read it, we probably should tell you our email address, which is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Now, we have an email from a listener named Julie who lives in London. And Michael, what does she say?
Her email says, "Hey, kids, I'm a CG animator." That's a computer graphics animator working in the UK just outside London, if you care. Of course we do, Julie. "And I listen to your show each week while working on my various projects. Last week, you highlighted a story about record companies planning to sell higher quality MP3s. According to a post I read on Gizmodo, these supposedly HD files, high definition, will be 24-bit. The same quality used in recording studios, not the 16-bit compressed versions we get on compact discs. At first, I thought this sounded like a great idea, no pun intended, but the author of the post has several issues with the idea. He gets rather technical, but he claims, 1, 24-bit is less noisy, which makes it good for use during recording, but is unnecessary for music which is mastered for playback and has no noise. 2, 24-bit offers a wider dynamic range, though compact discs already have a dynamic range, which is HD quality. And 3, 24-bit files are needed in recording studios to assist with digital effects, but these aren't used in consumer playback devices. And I'm sorry, there's even a fourth point, 4, 24-bit music files will be huge and may not play on all devices. You stated that the new high-quality files were meant to charge people more or make music fans purchase the music they already own. The gentleman who wrote this post agrees, though on a much more nerdy level. Thanks for the great show. Sincerely, Julie."
Wow. Well, thank you, Julie, for pointing that post out. Yes, I mean, 24-bit audio is really an audio quality that's used for very professional purposes and really isn't needed at the consumer level, because the reason you use 24-bit audio in the studio is, as mentioned, for digital effects and for noise levels. All of those things go away once you master the content for whether it be music or spoken word.
Nonetheless, I don't know what the specs are yet from iTunes, and I don't think the guy at Gizmodo knows either. I'd say, for example, when I worked at a alternative radio station in Champaign, Illinois, we would receive digital files in the WAV format as opposed to MP3, and most of the systems used to play music on air for radio stations, the automatic music playing systems, they demanded that you have a WAV file, W-A-V, instead of MP3. And this is just a much higher quality. And it's definitely a bigger file. Say an album that would come in, say, 50 megabytes would come in like 400 or 500 megabytes.
I was going to say, yeah, you need a lot of disk space.
If it was a WAV.
Yeah.
But the sound quality is absolutely playable and works great and sounds much more crystal clear and as good or better than compact disc, as opposed to the MP3, which is very compressed and does, in fact, sound a lot poorer. I mean, even an average person can tell if you're playing it on your stereo that you're listening to an MP3 as opposed to a fuller, richer sound. So if we can get, you know, people complained about CDs not being as good as LPs, and now we're listening to MP3s, which must have Neil Young rolling around in his grave. I think they can come
up
with a standard.
Neil Young is not dead yet, so you just killed off Neil Young.
I didn't mean to kill him off, but you know what I mean. He hates compressed sound. But I think there's a way to have a much higher quality sound quality without having the technical issues that this guy talks about with 24-bit. WAV, for example, provides that would give consumers a lot better sound for the music they have. And I agree, it's not going to get people to buy their old albums again, and I hope it costs the same as albums cost right now, and they're just going to offer this higher quality for the same price. But I guess if they have to deal with bandwidth of 10 times the amount, I guess they can't do that.
I guess not. But you don't have to deal with a lot of bandwidth to download our show from iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, which is where you can download those shows, or even subscribe to them. You can also subscribe in your RSS reader. You can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is the number to call. That's 888-567-7263. You can find all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com, which is also where you will find ways to keep up with us during the week on Facebook, Twitter, and other social networking sites. It's where you'll find our show notes for this episode and all of our past episodes. It's where you'll find information about both Michael and myself, as well as information about the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show, which is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. On our website, you'll find out that Michael Giltz can be found on his website.
My head is spinning.
Yes, this is the outro that's like Inception. you gotta remember which level of the outro you're actually in. But we're in the part where we talk about Michael's website. MichaelGiltz.com is his website, and he is on Twitter at Michael Giltz. Now, I'd like to thank both Eric Deggans and Andrew Wallenstein for joining us today. We'll place information about how to get in touch with them in the show notes. I can be found on celluloidjunkie.com, where some of my writing exists as well. I'm on Twitter. @Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.